Good morning, everyone. I'll just let that get settled. It's really nice to be here today. I'm not here on my own. You might have noticed that I have a faithful friend sitting with me. I want to introduce you to Lydia. Lydia lives with us, but although she's been introduced as my daughter at various churches, she is not. Although I like to think of her like I'm a bit like her mum. So Lydia doesn't look like me or my husband, and she doesn't speak like us either. She speaks with a Spanish accent. So if there's anyone in the room that speaks Spanish, please go talk to her. She misses it. So she's had to endure speaking Australian English for the last 18 months or so. Getting close, isn't it? Lydia comes from Panama, and she's here working as a volunteer for Faith FM. So she's actually a very brilliant IT engineer, and she does all of their back-end programming, all of their back-end coding. So she's a smart lady, and we've decided that we want her to stay, so she's looking for a husband. Just, sorry, Lydia. She's going to kill me later, but she was mean to me before, so I'm getting back. Okay, that's what happens. She told me that she was filling in for Michael because he would normally be mean to me before I preach, just to get me in line, and so she did it for him. Lydia, a husband would be good, it's second hand, you know, but she would like to stay and her family wouldn't want her to. It's that simple. But we've kind of adopted her, and she's one of two girls that we have that live with us apart from our daughters. So I have a 23-year-old and a 21-year-old daughter, and I have a 24-year-old and a 20-year-old adopted daughter. So it's really nice to have that family that we have live with us and to be a part of a bigger family that is this church, the Adventist Church. No matter where I've been in the country and in the world, there are people like you in the pews that make us feel welcome, and it's so amazing. Today, my sermon is actually called I'm Just a Nobody. And I want to take you through a journey of the Bible where we experience what it is to be pushed out of our comfort zone and to really understand that. I loved the comment that was made in the YPW section where you said that growth comes when you step out of your comfort zone. And that's so true. That's when we grow the most, is when we let God lead us and he pushes us off the edge. And we suddenly find that we're falling into faith and falling into him, and that's where we grow. And so today I want to tell you some stories that you will know, and hopefully I will stretch you a little bit into areas that maybe you didn't know about those stories, even the grey-haired people sitting in the congregation. I might get to teach you a little bit today. So I'm kind of dependent on a clicker, and they don't have one, so I'm going to have to just say to the guys at the back, can you click for me? So guys, can you click? Thanks. So I want to start with this. What I need to start with is prayer. Is that okay with you? That we just start with prayer. Father, thank you for being here today. Thank you for sending your spirit to be here. Please dwell among us today. Please have the words that I speak be from you. Inspire me with just the right message for the people sitting in this congregation, for the one person or the five people or the 20 people that need to hear this message today, Lord, speak through me. Thank you. Amen. Okay, I want to start with the story of Moses. So, because I'm a teacher, Yoshi introduced that, I'm a teacher, and actually my qualifications is that I'm a Bible teacher. So when I preach, I'm actually teaching, so I expect the class to answer my questions, okay? So you are my class today. So what is Moses' mum's name? Excellent. So the Bible tells us in Exodus 2 that she gives birth to Moses, and there's something about him. What does she see in him? There's a word that she uses, and it says, she looked at this little baby and she knew he was, what was it? Sorry? Oh, without a doubt, handsome. So, but it's an S word. She knew he was special. She knew he was special. I don't know, but when I looked at my kids, I thought they were pretty special, right? Did you not do the same when you looked at your kids? Yeah, that's special. But what was going on in the day that this was a big deal, that statement was a big deal? What was happening to the Israelites at that moment in time? What was happening to the boys? They were killing them, right? So they were being thrown into the River Nile and they were drowning them because Pharaoh was worried that the Israelites were becoming so strong and so many of them that if he didn't take it in hand, that they would overwhelm the Egyptians. And so he took it in hand. And first of all, he asked the Israelite midwives to kill them during the birthing process. And they refused to do that, which was really kind of cool. And then God blessed them with their own children. That's a nice aside. And so when Pharaoh called them in and they kind of went in before him and he said, "Why haven't you done what I instructed?" They said, "Oh, the Israelite women are so strong and so sturdy that when we arrive, the babies are already born and we can hardly kill them once they're in their mother's arms," right? And so when Jochebed gave birth to Moses, suddenly here was this child that she went, "He's special." Well, what made him more special than her neighbor's baby? Do you know what I mean? Why did she know that he was more special than every other baby boy that had been born that year? But she went to extreme lengths to protect him, right? She hid him for the first 3 months. I don't know about you, but if you've been around any baby for 3 months, what do they do in that first 3 months? Cry, feed, and, oh yeah, poop. I agree, poop. Yep, cry, feed, sleep, and poop. Okay, so that's what they do in the first 3 months. How do you hide that? Like, how do you keep that a secret? But somehow she managed to. For the first 3 months, the soldiers, Pharaoh's soldiers did not find him. But it gets to the stage where he's too big for this, right? So we know the story. She goes through the putting him in a basket, floating him on the Nile River. The princess comes along. How about that? She gets paid to look after her own son. We know all of the story, right? He ends up in the palace. He learns everything there is to know about being an Egyptian prince. He gets schooled in everything to do with the Egyptian royal family and what it is to rule in Egypt. He walks, talks, and dresses like an Egyptian. Take you back to the song. Okay? So, he's age 40, he becomes a murderer. I'm giving you the highlights, okay? Age 40, he becomes a murderer. The Pharaoh finds out about the murder. And so Moses stands his ground and says, "It's okay because I'm a prince." Is that what happens? What does he do? Okay, he flees, right? Where does he go? Oh, you guys are such a good class. He goes to Midian. Okay, who does he meet first? I love this part of the story. Who does he meet first? Sorry? Well, yes, but who else? She was there, but who else? After the first meeting. I love that Simone's got her Bible out and she's cheating because that's what you're allowed to do. No, it's not cheating. This is an open book test. Go, Simone, lead the way. Okay, so she's got it out. She's looking it up. Who does he meet first? Who does he meet first when he gets to Midian? Okay, let's take a step back. When he arrives in Midian, where does he stop? At the well. Okay, we've got that part. Why does he stop at the well? He needs a drink. Why doesn't he drink for himself then? Why is he still there when Zipporah and her six sisters turn up? Why is he still there? Exactly. The water's down there and he doesn't have the vessel to lift it, right? So he's thirsty as anything because he's just fled across a desert pretty unprepared for the journey. Right, he left in a hurry, fled across the desert, etc., etc. And as a result of his amazingly manly actions, he gets taken home to Jethro's home, and Jethro eventually gives him Zipporah as his wife, right? Now, seven daughters, I've got to tell you, Seven daughters. Anyone in the room have seven daughters? That's a lot of weddings. Right? That's a lot of weddings. Seven daughters. We actually, do you know whether Jethro had any sons? Does he have sons? Does the Bible tell us about sons? Okay, so in those days, Jethro would have been considered cursed. Do you get that? Why would he have been considered cursed? Not a son. The son was the heir. He had seven daughters. He never acted like he was cursed. What was Jethro in Midian? I'm literally trying to highlight and you're helping me. What was Jethro in Midian? Sorry? High priest. High priest. Great. So he was a man of God, yeah? So you've got, let's say that as tradition and Bible scholars will typically say that Moses moved into Pharaoh's palace at about age seven. We don't know. The Bible says a few years later. Okay? But most tradition, culture, and Bible scholars will tell us that he was probably about seven when he moved into the palace. He was 40 when he fled. How many years has he been indoctrinated into everything but God? 33. Okay, he's had 33 years of his life. And man, I've got to tell you, those first 7 years with his mum, I always say, give me a child till they're seven and I'll show you the adult. I'm not the first one that said that. But it's a really, really good saying, right? That core of a child is shaped in those first formative years. And I love that God didn't by mistake force Moses into the desert and force Moses to Midian and force Moses into the house of a high priest. The next 40 years were his training ground for who God really is. Got it? We see, and I'm not going to cover this, so I just want to point to it and then I'm going to jump back out of it. We see that when Moses is later on leading the people of Israel through the desert, that Jethro actually turns up. And Moses is having a huge amount of trouble trying to mediate all of the problems of a million people on his own. And Jethro gives him incredibly wise advice and he says to him, appoint leaders who the people can go to and they will manage the minor and medium things and let them just refer the big stuff to you. Jethro was a wise man, yes? Moses did that and things started getting better. So Jethro was a very wise man and he was a really good person for Moses to live with and to be trained. But I want to take you 40 years later. He's now 80 years old and he is a shepherd now. And he's actually gone out into the desert with his sheep and he stops near a mountain. What's the mountain called? Sorry? Okay, Sinai. It's got two names, yeah? Mount Sinai. I love the beautifulness of this story where his journey, his really first journey of encountering God starts at where he truly encounters God years later when he's there with the children of Israel. And I love telling the story to my classes where Moses actually says to God, let me see your face. And God goes, you can't see my face and live. And, you know, that whole story, and I have to tell it even though it's got nothing to do with the sermon, where God says to Moses, you know, I'm going to pass by you, but I'm going to hide you in the cleft of this rock. And I'm going to turn my back to you so you can't see the brilliance of my face. And I'm going to put my hand over your eyes as I pass by. And God does all of this protection of Moses. And then he passes by saying, Yahweh is my name, Yahweh is my name. I am who I am. And the cool thing is that Moses is on that mountain for 40 days. And when he comes down off the mountain, his face is still, come on, tell me, Arjunet, what's his face? So, and what do the Israelites say? Yeah, I love that she remembered part of it. So his face is so bright that the Israelites look at him and go, ah, cover yourself, we can't stand it. Don't do it. You're just like, we just can't look. It was like looking at the sun. That was the reflected glory of God's back 40 days later. Moses actually had to cover his face so that the Israelites could bear to be in his presence. And I always joke with the kids when I tell this part of the story. I say to them, how cool would it be when there's a million people and everyone goes, where's Moses? And you just have to look for the light. He's kind of a really cool representation of God, right? Just look for the light. We covered that in our Sabbath school lesson this morning. It was really cool. Look for the light. But I'm at that point where he's at Mount Sinai, and this is where I want to start. So if we can go to the next slide. God says to Moses, he encounters Moses, where? Where does he encounter Moses? Don't read my slide yet. It hasn't got your answers. Where does he encounter Moses? Burning bush, okay? What is the deal with the burning bush that's so fascinating for Moses? This is a 5-year-old question, so you guys can get it. It's not consumed. I would be interested by that, wouldn't you? Okay, you're out in the middle of nowhere, you're looking after your sheep, nothing much happens. And suddenly you see in the distance this bush on fire and you're like, oh, we're in the middle of the desert, not much fuel, it's okay, it'll go out soon. But it doesn't. And so Moses kind of watches for a while and he goes, it's not burning up. And so he wanders over to check it out a bit closer and the bush talks to him. Right? The bush talks to him, right? Oh, you guys, come on. Does the bush talk to him? Well, is it the bush? Who is it? God talks to him. And what does he say? Take off your... Because you are... Oh, yeah, you do know your stuff. Hallelujah. Take off your sandals. You are standing on holy ground. And Moses then gets this directive from God that he wants him to go back to Egypt and rescue his people, yeah? Moses' response, you can now throw that slide up. Moses' response, I say that at that point, Moses gets stage fright. He goes, I am not that person. Now, he is uniquely qualified for this because he spent 33 years learning everything about what it is to communicate with Pharaoh. He knows every part of Egyptian custom, culture, and royal protocol, doesn't he? There's no one else connected with the Israelites more prepared for this moment. And he says to God, I can't do it. Send someone else. I can't. And his excuse, here we go. Exodus 3, for those that want to follow along in their Bibles, but it'll be up on the slide here. But Moses protested to God, who am I to appear before Pharaoh? Who am I to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt? Who am I? You're kind of uniquely qualified. You're kind of the best person for the job, and you are the person that God has chosen from that very first moment when his mother looked at him and went, he's kind of special. He's more special than any of the other boys, and so I'm going to protect his life. Right? Who am I? And then he goes on, he gives his excuses to God now. He goes, Exodus 4 verse 10, but Moses pleaded with the Lord, oh Lord, I am not very good with my words. I never have been, and I'm not now. Even though you have spoken to me, I get tongue-tied and my words get tangled, so you can't make me do it. Okay. And God gets what with Moses? Yeah, he's angry, right? He's angry with Moses and he's like, oh, I've spent 80 years preparing you for this moment. Come on, man. Step out of your comfort zone. Growth comes when you step out. And Moses keeps arguing with God, I'm not the man that you think I am. And finally, God comes up with the second solution. He says, fine, we'll use your brother Aaron. He's on his way. He speaks well. I'll speak to you. You then tell him he can speak to Pharaoh. And the story goes on. And we're going to leave it there. We're going to jump to our next character who you know really well, I am sure. Because I'm talking about a young man who stands up for God in powerful ways and no one even has to push him out of his comfort zone. He runs out of his comfort zone. He leaps out of it. The young man's name is David, and the day is when he arrives in the Israelite camp to see Goliath standing there defying the army of Israel and challenging all that they stand for. And David says, 1 Samuel chapter 16, verses 6 and 7. Oh, no, this is a different part of the story. Hang on, I won't go to there. It's interesting because, I'll take a step back. It's interesting because when Saul had been chosen as king, how was he described to Samuel before Samuel met him? How was he described? Handsome. Yes. Big? Was he big? How big? Thank you very much and for your clear answer. A head taller than anyone else in the nation. So he was tall and he was handsome, ladies. Tall and handsome. I have a younger brother. I can't call him my little brother. He is my younger brother. He's 6'6". I come up to his armpit. Thank goodness he uses good deodorant. And, you know, as he was growing up, that whole idea of this, he was always big for his age, right? Always. Now, there's an expectation. I don't know whether any of you sitting out there have always been big for your age, tall for your age. There's an expectation with kids who are big and tall that they're actually older than their peers, right? And so people look at them and they go, why are you behaving that way? And they're actually behaving like a normal 8-year-old, but they look like a 10-year-old. Because of their height. Do you understand what I'm saying? And so it becomes a real issue for them. Well, I'm sure Saul had that half his life because he was good looking and tall. And my brother, I actually entered him in a master beauty competition at our local swimming centre when he was 4. He won. He won. Back in that day, you know, he won $20. For a 4-year-old, that was, I mean, and this is in the 70s. That was a decent little prize to take home to Mum, who wasn't at the swimming centre with us, because in those days you got sent on your own. And that was okay for the whole day. That was babysitting, right? So different today, yeah? I was in charge of him. So since I was in charge of him and I was a whole 4 years older, then it was absolutely my right to enter him into the beauty competition. That's how I saw it. Our other brother, who's 2 years older than me, wouldn't have a bar of it until he won. And then he was like, oh, yeah, it was totally my idea. It wasn't. Anyway, I sidetrack myself. So when Saul failed in his kingship, when he became too prideful to be a good king, God told Samuel that he was going to show him the man that was going to step into his place. And he sent him to, hang on, where did David come from? Sent him to what town? Bethlehem, yeah? Sent him to Bethlehem to meet with Jesse. And he was going, and God didn't tell Samuel who to choose. He didn't say, go find David. He didn't say that. He said, go there and I will show you which son of Jesse I want to anoint as the next king of Israel. Now, David was still a young man. What was his occupation, young ladies and gentlemen? Shepherd. How good was he at being a shepherd? How do we know that he was very good? Okay. So later on, and I want to kind of do this whole circuit, and we're going to come back. Can you hold that story? He killed lions and bears, right? We know that because of the, I'm going to tell you later, that part. Just shelve that idea for a second. So I want to remind you of what happens when Samuel goes to Jesse's home, and he wants to choose, like he wants to be directed by God. And so he follows the prescriptive pattern of what happened when Saul was chosen. And 1 Samuel 16, 6 and 7 says this, when they arrived, Samuel took one look at Eliab, David's brother, and thought, surely this is the God's anointed. Why? Because he was tall and good looking. No kidding. And that is where we get this famous verse that God doesn't look on the outer appearance of people, but God looks on the heart. And so Samuel's kind of like, oh, wow, God, we've changed the prescription for king. And so he goes through all six of Jesse's other sons, and God keeps saying, no, 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 not the one. And they literally run out of sons. And God has still said no, and Samuel's like, I'm sure this was the Jesse that I was being sent to. And he turns to Jesse and he says, have you no other sons? And they go, well, yeah, like the youngest one. In those days, what did the youngest son inherit? Yes, I'm getting a signal up here. Nothing. He was the least of the least, and his brothers reminded of it, him of it regularly, by the way. The least of the least. He was the one that was out in the field with the sheep when all of the brothers were in with Dad. He was the least of the least. He was never going to inherit a single thing from his dad except the trade, the tools of his trade, to be a shepherd. So he was the least of the least. And when he came in, God said to Samuel, this is the one. And he's still a young man. He wasn't tall and good looking yet. He was a young man who smelt like sheep. Have you been around many sheep? As Yoshi told you, I'm from New Zealand. There's more sheep than people over there. Sheep smell. And they're not really bright, right? They tend to follow the crowd really, really well. And if one jumps, they all jump, but there's nothing that they've jumped over. They literally do. I don't know whether you've ever seen it. One's walking along and one of the sheep goes, oop, and the others go, oh, there must be something there. So they all go, whoop. And it's like there was nothing there. Maybe the first one just wanted to jump. I don't know. But they all do it to follow. It's the weirdest thing. But David loved his sheep. We know this because of how he would sacrifice his own safety for the sake of his sheep, yeah? Now we go to the story of when he enters the Israelite army. I started it before and I waylaid myself. Goes into the Israelite army and here's Goliath. How tall is he? No, huge doesn't answer my question. Who's saying that? Say it again. 9 feet. Well done, Brian. He's 9 feet tall. You get a gold star. 9 feet tall. Now, do you understand how the armies were set up? You had the Israelite army on a mountaintop or a hilltop on this side, a valley in between, and the Philistines on a matching mountaintop, hilltop on the other side. So they all feel kind of safe from each other because they know when they're coming because there's a valley in between that they all have to go through to get to the other side. They get warned. Okay, their strategic positions have been chosen on purpose. So Goliath comes out every day. We know this, right? He comes out every day and he yells across, ha, I'm bigger and more powerful than you are. I'm paraphrasing just in case you didn't realize. And I defy any man to come and fight me. And if they win, what? What's the prize? If they win, we will be your slaves. And David arrives just in time to see today's show. And everyone's standing there trembling, the Bible says. And David goes, what's the problem? Really, what's the problem? And they're all going, oh, he's so big. And did you realize that Goliath didn't come on his own? He had brothers. And they weren't like my brother where, like, by the way, my younger brother, the 6'6" one, he's adopted. I didn't just get the short gene. He just happened to be in a family, you know, he had parents, obviously, that had really tall genes, right? So he's adopted. So I didn't get the short gene, but, you know, Goliath's brothers got the tall gene as well. So it wasn't just Goliath. He was, you know, he was there with a few other big dudes. And he had an armor bearer. Now, I want you to think about this. They describe the size of Goliath's shield. Now, I've got to feel sorry for the armor bearer. He has to hold it because when you're fighting hand to hand, did you realize that your armor bearer actually goes ahead of the soldier? And you have to carry the weight of that armor. You are actually more in the firing line than the guy you're protecting. Your job is to die first. Did you know that? The armor bearer's job is to die first. If in you being killed as the armor bearer, you protect the life of the guy that you're protecting, you've done your job well. If they have even a minute to run away or fight hand to hand, you've done a good job and you've actually done everything you were called to do. So Goliath's spear is like the end of the spear is like the size of my head. So his weapons were built to match him. They were huge. And David goes, are you kidding me? I could take this guy. I could. And he's kind of going, you know, I've killed lions and I've killed bears. I've killed them with what? What did he kill them with? No. Well, probably. But that's not what he says he did. Yes, and what? Bare hands and what? No, but good try. Bare hands and I think someone just said it. C-L-U-B. Come on, C-L-U-B. I'm giving you the answer. Put the letters together, it creates a word, C-L-U-B, a club. Okay, a club. If I am fighting with a club, how close do I have to get to you to kill you? Right, so I'm kind of bare hands and club, right? So he says to Saul, I killed lions and bears with my club. So he's literally saying, I went face to face. Now, I like testing you on your knowledge of animal life at this point. So tell me, how fast does a bear run? Yes, you can count on that. It was faster than him, but how fast? Do you want to take a guess? We could do it like an auction. Sorry? What did you say? Now, give me a number. 45. 30. It's faster than 30, whoever said that. 40. Okay, I'll take 40. Bears can run 40 kilometres an hour. And they're huge. And by the way, when they roar, their breath stinks. Like, it would knock you over. Not that I've been face-to-face with a bear, just to be clear. But I've read about it. And they, or even their fur smells, because they rip through rotten flesh. And so they just don't smell pleasant. They're worse than sheep. All right, so we've got a 40-kilometre-an-hour running bear that he's taken on with a club. So you don't get a lot of warning when this thing is bundling towards you at 40 k's an hour and you're there to protect your sheep. Okay, how fast do lions run then? She's looked it up or she knew it. Did you look it up in advance, Gosha? Well done. See, I don't mind cheating. You're allowed to use the resources at your hand. Go, Gosha. Yes. It's like I prepared you in advance for that. Yay. Okay, 80 kilometres an hour is the speed of your typical lion. So that's double the speed of a bear, right? So, yet he takes it on. So he goes, this 9-foot dude? Hello? And there's one thing that you all seem to have forgotten. We have God on our side, right? And I love what he says, and I'm not going to even talk about him trying on Saul's armour and stuff. You all know that part where he goes, oh, I don't think so. And he walks out to fight Goliath, and on the way he picks up 5 stones, little pebbles, right? Just they have to be perfect. So he's looking on the ground as he goes, because the only weapon he takes into the battle is a sling. He goes into a sword fight with a stone. Okay? But this is what he says. We'll have the next slide. This is what he says to Goliath. He says, you came to me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of heaven's armies, the God of the armies of Israel who you have defied. Today, this is really critical. So I'm stopping to tell you, you need to really take in these next words, okay? Today, and I put it in capitals to make sure that you got it. Today, the Lord will conquer you and I will kill you. So who's he explaining to Goliath is going to conquer him? Is it David? Today, I'm going to kill you. No, he makes it really clear. Today, the Lord is going to conquer you and I'm going to kill you. And then for all of the gruesome people in the audience, and then I'm going to cut off your head. Right? He does too, doesn't he? Like, if you know the story well, once he's killed Goliath, he goes over, pulls Goliath's own sword out of his sheath and uses Goliath's own sword to cut off his head and lifts it by the hair and carries it back as his trophy. That was very normal in battle in those days. The head of your enemy was your proof that you had been in battle and you had conquered. That was normal. And in fact, to prove to Saul that he did it, he takes the head to Saul and keeps the sword for himself. Which, by the way, big sword. Keeps the sword for himself. Actually gets it later. When does he get it back? Sorry? Exactly. When years later, he's now an outcast and he goes to the temple and he's starving, so is his men, and the priest gives him the holy bread and Goliath's sword. It was kind of his right, right? It's the only weapon he then has at that point, but we're not talking about that either. That was just another sideline. So, Jesus is now on earth, and he chooses 12 disciples. How qualified were they? Way qualified, right? Like, he had to steal them from other rabbis, didn't he? Like, he went to all of the rabbi schools and he chose the most qualified disciples of the other rabbis so that he had the best team on his side. Isn't that how it went? Do you realize how young men became disciples in those days? Do you know that history? Do I need to tell you? Because it will take some time and I'll end up being really late. Is that okay? Okay, all right, I just got permission. So if there's an issue with how long I speak, thank you. Okay, so back in those days, and this is really important history and it really helps to know because you just get this picture of this story so big, right? Okay, so in those days, young Jewish boys were sent to Jewish school, and in the years that they were there, they had to learn the Torah by heart, word for word. And at the end of their time at school, the rabbis came in because they were there to choose their protégés. They were there to pick the cream of the crop. And so they would sit down with these young men and they would test them on their understanding, not that they had memorized it, but they had understood what they had learned. And they would test them on their understanding. And the test kind of went like this. And you've got to stay with me. You've got to focus on this because this is important. Okay, so I'm the rabbi and I ask you a question. And you know the answer to the question, but you can't give me the actual answer. To prove that you're smarter than me, you have to answer the question with a question of your own where the answer is embedded in your question. Got that? And the rabbi goes, ooh, clever. And so then he asks you a harder question without answering your question specifically, but his answer is embedded in his next question. And you go, not bad. And it goes on. So no one actually gives a straight answer. It would be very frustrating, but incredibly entertaining to be in one of those situations. And if you come to the point where the rabbi goes, this dude, he's good. He then says to you, come and be my disciple. And you get chosen to walk with him and learn from him. And the saying goes that a disciple of a rabbi walks so closely with him that he is covered with the dust of his sandals. You know that you're a good disciple if you are walking so closely with your rabbi that you are covered with the dust of his sandals. Because remember, it was dirt roads in those days. Sandals would flick up the dirt and you're walking so closely behind him and following everything he does. I joke with kids that you know what that means? It means that when the rabbi eats, you eat. And when the rabbi goes to the bathroom, right? You covered by the dust of your rabbi. Now, all of these disciples, these 12 men that Jesus chose to be his closest confidants, his followers, and then eventually the leaders of the early Christian church, how many of them passed that test? Zero. He went and pulled them out of See, what happened with the boys who weren't chosen by the rabbis was that they were sent home to learn their father's trade or continue their father's trade. So you find amongst Jesus's rebel rousers, fishermen, publicans, tax collectors, and, you know, hello? They weren't the ones that we would choose today, right? Like, if we're wanting to rise up a new church, we're going to be looking for the brightest, the smartest, the best, the ones that can answer the questions and speak eloquently and not chop off someone's ear, right? And yet he chooses these guys, and they become so critical to the ministry that became the early Christian church and then where we are today. So, can I have the slide with the photo, please? Okay. Can you see me? I'm the little one in the front, the cute one. Okay, this is me with my siblings of the time and my cousins. It's the only photo that we have like this. I was maybe 3 in that photo, so my younger brother hadn't come on the scene yet. And if you had told that little girl or even my 16-year-old self that I would be standing here today in front of you, I would have laughed you out of the room. Because I was literally nobody. Literally. When my husband and I started in ministry, the question that we were maybe most regularly asked is, who are you? Who are you? Like, they want to know what our pedigree was. Like, who are you related to? What's your Adventist history? Who are your family? Well, my husband comes from a non-Christian family. Like, he was sure that by the time he was an adult, at 13, he was sure that by the time he was an adult, Christianity would have been gone from the earth because it was so irrelevant. So that's his pedigree. My pedigree is that I am 4th-generation Adventist to a family that nobody knows in a tiny country in a small city. And even in New Zealand, we don't know each other. Like, I actually have had people, I don't know whether this has happened to you, oh, you're from Melbourne, do you know so-and-so? I actually had people say, oh, you're from New Zealand, do you know, and I'm like, do you know how many million people are there? No, I don't know everyone, and they sure don't know me, right? I was nobody. In fact, I was so nobody. I left school at the end of year 11. My family were poor. I grew up in government housing. We were poor. I didn't realize poor was something to be ashamed of until I was 8 years old, when a teacher showed me that poor was something to be ashamed of. And I was like, wow, I should be ashamed of my family then. Wow, I should be ashamed that I live in a government house then. Wow, okay, then I'm not as good as the other kids in my class then. And I had that moment as an 8-year-old. And by the time I was in year 11 and I'd failed maths in year 7, 8 and 9 because I had the same teacher for 3 years. And I went to a huge public school, about 1,500 kids. There had to have been at least 10 maths teachers in that school and I got the same one 3 years in a row. I wasn't used to failing because I knew that education would be my breakthrough. And my breakthrough was just getting a good job. That was my breakthrough. It wasn't university or anything else. And so I worked hard in primary school. I did well. And then I hit high school and I failed maths. And the first year I was like, this can't be happening. So I took myself to tutoring. Guess who was the tutor? No kidding, same teacher. So I'm going, it's okay, I'm going to persist because in a smaller group I'll probably get it. She could have been speaking a different language. It was harder than listening to Lydia speak. She speaks great English, by the way. It was like, wow, by the second year, I was like, okay, I'm not giving up, I'm going to keep going. So I kept going to tutoring and I still didn't get it. By the third year, I had come to a conclusion. I was maths dumb. There was no point you trying to teach me maths because obviously my maths brain just didn't work. It had died. Now, I could go on with that story, but I had a teacher in year 10 who believed in me, and he actually got me passing maths. But the ridiculous thing is that a month before the end of year 11, I left school. I was not a happy person at school. My best friend had left school in year 9 because her family had moved to towns. I was one of only 4 Christians that I knew at the school, and I wasn't happy. The other 3 were boys. And although when she was with me, we used to hang out together, when she left, it was me and 3 boys, and we all got teased that we were all kind of hanging out together. So I just separated, and I just chose to not be with them to save them, and I was then on my own, because by then, in a school that size, friends have already been established, yeah? So I left. I told my parents I was leaving, and they were like, righto, okay, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to get a job. And I did, in a bank. I don't kid you. I got a job in a bank. The girl who failed year 7, 8, and 9 maths went and worked in a bank, and I was literally handling and balancing millions of dollars a day. And I did really well. And by the time I was 20, I was in charge of customer services and had 30 staff working for me. And I was like, wow, I could be good at this, right? Wow. And then somewhere through that, I ended up being the trainer for every person on staff that wanted to learn something. I was the one that was asked to train them. And I went, I really enjoy doing this training thing. And somewhere in some distant past, I'd had this dream that maybe one day I'd be a teacher. But my family couldn't afford to send me to uni, and there was no university in my city where I grew up. And so I would have had to have left home, and the expense of that would have been more than I could manage, right? So I didn't do it. And I kept using the excuse of my family's poverty for my fear. Until one day I went, you know what? I can't use that anymore. I've got to do something for myself. And so I started saving, and I went and got a second job. I worked at McDonald's. Yep, I did. I worked at the bank from 8:30 till 5, and at 5:15 I clocked in at McDonald's. I was meant to be there at 5, but they knew that I was crossing over. I clocked in at 5:15 and I worked till 11:30 at night. And I did that for a year and a half, 17, 18-hour days. I had grown up poor. We worked hard. That was nothing for me. We worked hard. You work hard to survive, to put food on the table, right? I'm sure I'm not the only one that's come from poverty in this room. And we survived, and I decided that if I could save money, I could go and be a teacher. And then I decided that if I was going to be a teacher, I wanted to be a Christian teacher. And that meant leaving my country behind, leaving my family behind, and moving to Australia to go to Avondale College. And I did it. I moved here with nobody that I knew because I was nobody. So I didn't have any connections with anybody. And I went to Avondale and I ran out of money after my first year. And that's another story for another sermon. But you know what? Nobody's get used by God. Nobody's become somebody's when they turn their lives over to God and they say, I will do whatever you ask me to do. When you step out of your comfort zone, when you are prepared to push yourselves into places you never thought you would go, you become the person that God intended you to be. Now, I've got a second half of the sermon that, looking at the time, I cannot have. So if you want to hear the rest of it, you're going to have to invite me back at some point, because the rest of it is awesome. It's actually the point of the sermon. But I'm hoping that today I have left you with something to think about, because I want you to sit here and go, what was I meant to be? And I don't care if you're as old as I am, and I'm 120. Isn't that right? 51. Oh, shush, already. Oh, man, she ruins all my secrets. I tell the kids I'm 120 because, you know, they always ask how old you are. Even if you're as old as me, you are not so old that you can't be pushed out of your comfort zone. But you've got to let God direct it. And you've got to be prepared to say, even if I don't speak well, even if I don't have a sword and armor, God is going to fight for me. This is his battle, and I'm going to kill you. Well, I don't want you to go out and kill it, you know. You didn't hear me say that I want you to go out and kill people, right? But I'm going to kill the problem that's in front of me. I'm going to fight against the barrier that's holding me back from being the person God wants me to be. Even as a 21-year-old, when I moved to this country, I wouldn't believe that I could be standing here today. I had no intention of marrying a pastor. In fact, my mum spent a good 3 hours trying to talk me out of it. Truly, she did. And at the end of it, I said to her, "Mum, there's just one problem." And she said, "What's that?" And I said, "I love the guy." She hadn't even met him. She hadn't even met him. He was in Australia and I was in New Zealand during this conversation. I went back to tell my family that I was getting married to an unknown guy. My dad, the first time he spoke to my husband, said to him, who was my boyfriend, "What are your intentions for my daughter?" I was so embarrassed, right? But I want to know what your father in heaven is asking about you. What are your intentions for your child? And I'm talking about you. What are your intentions for you that you honour him? You are not too old, even if you have grey hair. Mine's covered with dye. Okay? You are not too old, even if you can't walk anymore. There is still stuff that God is calling you to do. Step out of your comfort zone. Let him use you in powerful and magnificent ways. And I really want to do that other sermon at some point, so let me know, okay? Thank you, everyone.